From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. President Obama welcomed leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council to Camp David to reassure them about U.S. commitments to their security. But only two of six heads of state attended, and Obama stopped short of offering the formal defense pact some GCC countries had sought to counterbalance an impending nuclear agreement with Iran. There were conflicting reports from South Korea over whether North Korean leader Kim Jong-un had ordered the execution of his defense minister in a particularly gruesome manner. The Vatican announced that it has reached agreement with the Palestinians on an accord extending formal recognition to a Palestinian state. At the same time, a narrow new right-wing Israeli government took office, diminishing already slim prospects for a negotiated two-state solution. And finally, in the United States, potential Republican presidential nominee Jeb Bush stumbled in his answers to questions about whether he would have authorized the 2003 invasion of Iraq, a key foreign policy legacy of his brother, President George W. Bush. Tom, let's start with the GCC summit. King Salman of Saudi Arabia did not attend. The leaders of Bahrain, Oman, and the UAE also stayed home. So only the emirs of Kuwait and Qatar attended. Now, the leaders of Oman and the UAE are in poor health, but Salman had said he was going to come, and this summit was mostly about symbolism. So what did the fact that only two of the six leaders show mean about the symbolism of this summit?
Well, I think, Barbara, that it shows what we already knew, which is Gulf state leaders are very concerned about President Obama's determination to get, if he can, get a nuclear deal with Iran. The Gulf state leaders view Iran as the most mortal threat they have to their existence, and they're very nervous about it. Now, the symbolism that the King of Saudi Arabia, who is the major player here, sending a deputy crown prince.
And a crown prince,
right. It's pretty heavy hitters, but it was not the king who, as recently as 3 days before the conference, had said he would definitely be there, and then suddenly he wasn't. It just shows that the Gulf state leaders and some other Arab nations, are very, very nervous about this. So the symbolism is not good. It's yet another indication that some longstanding allies in the Arab world are nervous about the Obama administration's leadership. And I think the main purpose of the summit was to reassure them. And like most situations like this, the wording, the diplomatic language at the end of the conference at Camp David, the president's private retreat in the mountains of Maryland, seemed to suggest all was well, but everybody knows that's not the case. The president spent a lot of time reassuring his other colleagues that, in effect, we're not going to sell them out to get a deal with Iran. On the other hand, the president said he was absolutely determined to do it. So I think it was a wash at best, and maybe a small net minus for the president, but it was something he had to do.
Yeah, I mean, he did say that, you know, protecting the Persian Gulf region is a, quote, fundamental tenet of U.S. foreign policy that goes back 70 years. But he had a terrible slip in his he had a private meeting at the White House with the Crown Prince and the Deputy Crown Prince. And he talked about 70 years previously when FDR met with King Faisal. Of course, it was King Abdulaziz, the founder of Saudi Arabia. King Faisal came later. So, you know, Obama didn't even get his history right. The other thing that struck me was that in his comments at Camp David, you know, they talked about increasing cooperation on the military front, more military exercises, more cooperation on cyber crime, on terrorism, and so on. But then he also said that the purpose of security cooperation is not to perpetuate any long-term confrontation with Iran or even to marginalize Iran. And that, I think, puts him in direct confrontation with the GCC because they want to marginalize Iran, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. They're nervous as can be about Iran. And so this has not been the smoothest diplomatic engagement I've seen out of the Obama White House. I mean, that language is problematic for a lot of countries that go well beyond the Arab world.
Yeah. Oren, we're talking obviously about the statements, the deliverables that came out of Camp David. There wasn't much, was there? There was an agreement to have another summit next year and talk about more military exercises, making it easier for the Gulf states to buy weapons. But was it what they hoped to achieve when they came to Washington?
I would say no. The Gulf Arab monarchies came to Washington wanting a firm commitment, not just a commitment, but an actual defense treaty with the United States.
Well, some of them did, yeah, UAE, for example.
Some of them, similar to what the United States has with Japan or with NATO, with European countries and NATO. They did not get that. They also wanted not only more weapons, but they wanted the most advanced American weapons. It doesn't seem like they got that either. There are people in Congress who are concerned about maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge, and they don't want to make the Gulf Arab nations have more advanced weapons than Israel. So the Gulf countries did not get everything they wanted, but I think they had an opportunity to express their concerns about the Iranian nuclear deal.
Mm-hmm. And also, of course, Tom, the administration had an opportunity to explain the Iranian nuclear deal in a little bit more detail. I assume that they got the latest briefing on what actually is going to be in this long-term agreement.
Well, they did, and that was another main function of this summit, to try to reassure the Gulf state leaders that they were not being sold out for a deal, and that the deal, while President Obama is really committed to one if he can get it by June 30th, has safeguards. The Obama administration believes there are safeguards that will protect both Israel and nervous Gulf allies in the Arab world, and we will have to see about that. Whether they are reassured remains to be seen. I suspect that in the days ahead, we're going to be seeing some nervous, unidentified Arab officials talking about how concerned they are still. Mm-hmm. Concern, whatever.
Yeah. Time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Oren Durrell and Tom DeFrank, and we were talking about the GCC summit. Just one last point on this before we move on, Oren. I was in some meetings off record with some of the Arab leaders who actually were looking to the United States to somehow mediate between them and Iran, which I thought was extraordinary. I mean, if you look at the region now, there are all these proxy conflicts going on in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq. And to me, it seems very strange that the Saudis and the Iranians aren't able, for example, to talk to each other without using the United States, which has no diplomatic relations with Iran, as an intermediary.
Yeah, that is kind of remarkable. One thing I think that is worth mentioning, kind of going back to what were the whole point of the summit and some of the kind of overarching concerns related to it, is that there are Saudi leaders and others in the Gulf who have said that this deal with Iran, which basically limits Iran's nuclear program for, up to 10 to 15 years, and then expires, parts of it expire at that point, that basically how long it takes to build a domestic nuclear program. And the Saudis have come out and said, leading up to the summit, that if Iran gets the capacity to continue to enrich uranium, that they're going to get that capacity too. And there's a very large worry that the deal that is aimed at controlling the nuclear program in Iran and staunching proliferation in the Gulf will actually end up doing the opposite, that it will allow the Iranian nuclear program to continue and lead to proliferation in the Gulf. So this summit is these issues, this conflict between Iran and the Saudis and the Shiite Iran and the Sunnis and Sunni Arabs in the Gulf. It's sort of coming to a head, and I think what you encountered was concern that this thing could get worse.
Yeah, yeah, it may indeed. It may indeed. And on the proliferation aspect, of course, the countries of the GCC, to get these kinds of nuclear programs, I mean, Iran has been working on its nuclear program off and on since the days of the Shah, so it takes a long time to build infrastructure and expertise, and countries like Saudi Arabia really, really don't have that. The UAE is just starting down that path. So sometimes I think there's a little bit more rhetoric than reality in their threats. The other thing is that ultimately they do depend on the United States to guarantee them against external threats, as President Obama said. And so that gives the U.S. some leverage in terms of what these countries can do on the nuclear front. But let's move on to another country that actually has nuclear weapons and that has been showing some really strange behavior lately, Tom. Not that it hasn't always, but that's North Korea. This was something that came out at me that's just incredible. According to the South Korean spy agency, since Kim Jong-un took power in 2011, 72 senior military and party officials in North Korea have been purged, have been executed. And, of course, there were conflicting reports about whether the latest one to go was a guy named General Hyun Yong-chol, who was the defense minister and, according to some reports, Tom, was executed with anti-aircraft weapons, which really seems like the definition of overkill. What do we know about this, and what can you make of this 30-year-old Kim Jong-un, who is, in charge?
Well, it suggests to me, Barbara, that he's trying to be in charge, and he's desperate and paranoid about threats to his authority, real and imagined. Certainly paranoid. I mean, I think it was about, 18 months or 2 years ago that he had his uncle, senior Army general, executed. And I have no doubt that there is a huge purge underway. But the whole notion of being executed with an anti-aircraft missile is a little far-fetched, even for the North Koreans. I tell you, if you can't sleep some night and want to have some real fun, go to the North Korean official website, and they use things like Yellow Dog and imperialist Nazis, and the rhetoric on this website is not to be believed. It's so juvenile and childish and amateurish. But I suspect we're going to find that this defense minister was in fact executed, and we'll find that out in a few days or so. But that's the bottom line. This kid mm-hmm. Is struggling to maintain his authority, to establish his authority, and he's willing to do whatever he has to do to purge enemy people that he mm-hmm. believes are his enemy. And the bottom line there is it's clearly another example of yet more instability in a country that
has 10 nuclear weapons.
Right, precisely.
Yeah, right? I mean, apparently the crime of this general, Oren, was that he fell asleep during a lecture that Kim Jong-un was giving. And, I remember his father, Kim Jong-il, was also a little strange, but he had a policy of what he called military first. And he did everything he could to safeguard the military and to nurture his generals. So is this wise in the long term? I mean, if people keep getting executed for minor offenses, that would seem to maybe be cause for a coup at some point.
It could. We're looking at a leader who, first of all, canceled a trip to Moscow also mm-hmm. in the past few weeks. Mm-hmm. And then we find out about this general being executed. So he seems to be uneasy about even leaving his country. Mm-hmm. He's so insecure. We're talking about a leader whose regime hacked Sony for a juvenile movie about his assassination and threatened acts of terror at American movie theaters over the showing of a film. So we're not talking about someone who's particularly secure in his leadership. But at the same time, if you look at the people who are being executed, the pattern that I see is a lot of very senior and much older leaders who are undoubtedly being replaced by younger people that probably he can rely on, or he feels that he can rely on. So I think that the policy that he has is Kim Jong-un first, mm. and then maybe military first, but that his first priority is to keep himself safe. And whether that leads to a coup or not, I don't know.
Tom, in Asian culture, there's supposed to be a reverence for people who are older. So, I mean, this is shocking on so many levels. But, are there contingency plans? What happens? There have been a lot of alarming reports that North Korea is increasing its nuclear arsenal. Does China have a plan B? Does South Korea have a plan B? Does the U.S. have a plan B in case that place implodes?
Well, I think the military, the U.S. military, has a plan B. They've been there since the end of the Korean War or the Korean armistice. The military has a contingency plan, but I don't know what you do, how you deal with the reality of you've got a kind of a unstable leader here. It's going to be tricky. And the other thing that's disturbing to a lot of U.S. officials is the Chinese are the closest thing to a mentor to the North Koreans. And in the past, the Chinese have been able to establish some persuasive powers here. You get a feeling that this President Kim is not listening to anybody, including the Chinese, which is worrisome.
I want to get to the Palestinian issue, but Tom, I want to go first actually to Jeb Bush and U.S. domestic politics, which have a link to foreign affairs. Last few days, we've seen some extraordinary comments by Jeb Bush. He's been asked what he would have done in 2003 with Iraq, and he said to an interviewer from Fox News that he would have invaded. Then he said that his response was misinterpreted. Then he said it was hypothetical and he couldn't say. And then finally he said, well, if we knew then what we know now, no, I wouldn't have. How does all of this reflect on Jeb Bush and reflect on his viability as a candidate for the Republican nomination, should he choose to run?
Poorly, very poorly. What it shows at best is that Jeb Bush is a little rusty after having not run a campaign for 14 years. The political world has turned upside down in the last 14 years, and he didn't have a good week. There's no doubt about it, Barbara, but it also shows that he was not prepared to deal with something that he should have been prepared for from day one, which is how do you handle the business with his brother, former President George W. Bush. I mean, I often say the Bush name is an asset to Jeb Bush, but it's also a big liability.
Sure.
And that is the problem, and it seems like he wasn't ready to deal with this. I mean, he had a terrible 4 or 5 days. On the other hand, it's about 560 days until the next election. I think the real problem for this is, as you suggest, Barbara, in the Republican primary process, there are a lot of Republicans who don't think Jeb is, he's not their first choice. He's too establishment. He's too moderate of a conservative. He's another Bush. And this just gives grist or fuel to the fire to those Republicans who think he's a yesterday's person, and it's even worse that his name is Bush. So he hasn't performed well, and that's going to hurt him in the primaries, unless he starts winning somewhere 6 months from now.
All right. Time now for another break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa Weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Oren Durrell and Tom DeFrank. Oren, yeah, as Tom said, this is the one question that you would think Jeb Bush would have prepared for. What accounts for the fact that he, sort of meandered back and forth between various answers?
Well, one of the things that I saw was that he said that he misunderstood the question and that his initial response was that he thought the question was based on what they knew then and not based on what they know now. The question was about what they, considering what you know now, would you?
Yeah, but
would
the
you
question was, and I'm quoting, knowing right. what we know now,
right.
would
and,
you have authorized
the
invasion?
And he said later that he misinterpreted the question. He was answering a different question.
I think there's another point, Barbara, and that is it's a problem for Jeb Bush in the larger context of his brother. He's been saying to off-the-record fundraising breakfasts and lunches, I am my own man. My name is Bush, but I'm different from, I love my father, I love my brother, but I'm Jeb. I'm not them, and my policies are very different from them. And you square that with what he's said in the recent couple of weeks, which is, my brother is my best advisor on Middle East policy. And so he has a tightrope to walk. He has to figure out a way to distance himself from his brother, who left office as a very unpopular president, and he's not doing that very well either. So it's one of those horrible, no good, not very nice, unfortunate weeks for Jeb Bush. The only good thing for Jeb Bush is the election is 18 months away, and the first primary balloting is 6 months away. So he has time to recover. It's always good for a politician if you're just doing really poorly is to get it out of the way early. The key is, can he not repeat these kind of things, or is this an example of a systemic problem? We'll know in the next few months.
I think one of the things that this points out in the broader picture is that the Republicans still don't have a front runner, and the Democrats obviously do in Hillary Clinton. And every time one of these, gaffes or mistakes happen on the Republican side, it sort of derails another campaign, or slightly derails another campaign.
Yeah, and obviously Hillary, is in a better position since she, at this point at least, doesn't have to defend. Well, we'll see. She will have to defend, won't she? Yeah. Obama's policies, at least on the issues where she was involved when she was Secretary of State. Of course, she has not given a press conference for a while, so Jeb Bush has been out there, and he was confronted by a student who said, well, your brother created the group that calls itself the Islamic State by invading Iraq. And he didn't have a good answer for that either. So I think he's going to need to bone up. So we will now switch to our final topic, and that is the Palestinian issue and Israel. Or a couple of developments in recent days. The Vatican made more formal its recognition of Palestine. It's apparently reached a fairly detailed agreement on how it will recognize the Palestinian state. And this puts the Vatican in the company now of a number of other countries. I think there's something like 130 countries that technically recognize Palestine. What does this do for Israel and for its position in the international community?
First of all, what the Vatican did was it said that it's going to recognize the state of Palestine, and the Vatican has a very big, actually has a major role in the peace negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, because it represents the largest constituency of Christians, and therefore has a say on the disposition of Jerusalem, which mm-hmm. both sides, both the Palestinians and Israelis, claim as their capital. And it's a multi-religious, multi-denominational city, and the religious authorities have a say, and the Vatican's therefore have a very large say. So that's it's actually a very important player with regards to that very important mm-hmm. issue. Internationally, this sort of adds to Sweden.
Actually, it's 135 UN yeah. members now recognize the Palestinian state. 160 UN members recognize Israel. So they're only 35 behind.
Right.
25 behind.
So it creates sort of like, the Palestinians are saying that this creates a momentum and they're behind them becoming a state and increasing pressure on Israel. And they're hoping to increase pressure on Israel through all these international organizations and through divestment and getting people to stop, maybe even imposing to the point of imposing sanctions on Israel or not doing business with Israel, which Israel has been exposed to some of that all along. Mm-hmm. The Israelis say it's not going to have any impact because at the end of the day, they have to talk to the Israelis mm-hmm. in order to have a state and in order to have their independence and in order to have the all the things that there's a lot of interconnectedness between Israel and the territories. So the Israelis are saying, as a practical matter, this has very little impact. They're saying you still have to talk to us, and this is actually sort of going in the opposite direction from negotiations, which mm-hmm. is what they say right. needs to happen.
Of course, now with this narrow right-wing government taking power with only 61 seats in the Knesset and very much a hawkish pro-settlement government, it doesn't look likely that there are going to be any Israeli-Palestinian talks anytime soon, which also probably fuels this international effort, yeah?
Well, that's sort of the thing, is that the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, especially under the Netanyahu government, haven't been going anywhere. Yeah. And the Kerry-Obama initiative to bring them about failed. So we'll see. There'll be some more of this happening for years to come, I think.
Yeah. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.